Hello, and welcome to the podcast Pathways from Warwick Chemistry. This week, we'll be talking to Dr. David Fox. We'll be chatting about his journey to where he is. I'll let him tell you guys more. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, yes. Hello, Matt. Yes, I am David Fox, and I am indeed an academic at University of Warwick in the chemistry department. I'm only an associate professor. I haven't reached those great heights. And I, this will set the tone for the podcast, and I probably never will. But that's a choice, right? Because, if you're here to talk about pathways, then, let's talk about all of the various possibilities, right? And what life has to offer people. So, being an academic is an odd thing. I mean, the university is is always trying to evolve. It's always trying to improve. It's always trying to invest. And, we spent a lot of time recently talking about changes to the course, changes to the infrastructure, changes to the building even. They're thinking about a new building that's going to come in the next 10 years. That's very exciting as well. So really, being an academic in the middle of all of that is often quite an interesting thing because, students come, students go, right? But we're sort of semi-permanent fixtures. And we have to sort of change with the university. And I think what you realize very quickly is that there isn't really a single path, right? To use your word, pathways, there isn't really a single pathway, I don't think. I can tell you a little bit about how I got here. I suppose I was really fortunate when I was young, right? My father was a farmer. Right. Hello to all you, sons and daughters of farmers out there. You know what I mean. So in a slightly odd way, without suddenly sounding all entrepreneurial, because I never really saw my father as being like that. But, my dad sort of owned and ran a business. Yeah. And it was a particularly large business. Well, not economically. I mean, physically, it was quite large, farms, fields and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So, but I think most importantly was a very interesting early life because there was always things to do, right? There was always somewhere to go outside and there was always something to do, help me dad. And he was always doing things, sometimes he was mending things or digging things or driving tractors and all that kind of thing. And he spent a lot of time in the workshop fixing things, building bits of machinery, all that kind of thing. And so I suppose I've always liked that kind of thing, right? I've always liked the hands-on aspects of life. And I particularly, and even now, I still like going in the lab. I still like fixing things. And usually when things break, actually, the guys call me downstairs and I have a go at trying to fix them, right? So that sort of, it's terrible. I don't want to sound like it's some sort of cheesy thing, but this idea of, people do stuff. I am a person, therefore I can do stuff. I'm not saying I'm going to do it well, but, if somebody can fix this or mend this or do this, then I suppose I can have a go too. I'm not arrogant enough to believe I'll be great at it, but, I can start, right? So it's this thing. It's just sort of about having a go. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot to be said for being quite flexible as well and having a go at a wide variety of things.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Which is what I think farming kind of teaches you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You can try lots of things and you can succeed and fail, right? But as long as you're understanding and flexible about what you can do and what the results you're expecting, you can make good progress and learn lots of stuff, right?
Well, most of the things you're going to do in life, you're going to fail at, right? Because actually, otherwise you'd never, you can't just roll the dice every time and go and pick some new activity and go, and then have a go and be awesome at it. I could try anything. You learn very quickly. I am the sort of person, that needs a ruler in order to draw a circle. That's how good my artistic talent is. And, things like this. There's all kinds of things out there. You're hopeless at, and that's fine. And I try and avoid them. Just for everybody else's benefit mainly. But you have a go at things in life and after a while you sort of work out what you can do and what you can't do. And so I suppose all the way through my education and my job. I'm trying to avoid the word career. Well, the only time I like to use the word career is a verb, really, rather than a noun, you know, because I feel I have careered, not really that I have a career. And that it's, you know, I've just ended up doing what I do because somehow I just, you know, quite enjoyed it. People keep paying me. And so that's that, really. You know, there's a lot to be said for that, right? There's a lot to be said for just doing something you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it's one of those things, and it goes with the saying, if you enjoy what you do, you won't work a day in your life, right?
Yeah, that's it. You know, and, you know, there we go, with my senior tutor hat on, because I'm senior tutor in the department, is I'm always having sort of attempting to steer people towards some sort of success. And you know, and I often say to people when they get onto the subject of jobs or careers, and it's like, well, you know, what do you actually like doing? And is there some way you can get paid to do it? You know, that's it. That's the way forward. Because, you know, jobs are somebody else's definition of a career, right? I mean, you know, do you want to do this thing here or that thing there?
Yeah. So going through your undergrad, did you find that you knew you wanted to go into medicinal chemistry and
no,
do the work that you do now?
Absolutely not. Didn't like biology. What was all that about? Don't need to do with that. So always liked organic chemistry. Like that, curly arrows. Thank you, Mr. Adams. Just want to name check my sixth form chemistry teacher. Thank you. Who first taught me curly arrows. So really liked doing that. And yeah, always did the organic chemistry as much as I could. Really at the time was a bit of a numerophobe. Really struggled with year one maths for anybody else who was out there. I remember some moment. I remember once sitting in a lecture about Lagrangian multipliers. I still don't know what one is or whether or not it has teeth. What the hell is this? So anyway, so I'm sure they're great. Anyway, for those of you out there who understand what that is. It was just not for me or that kind of thing. And I suppose I only as a, finally, when I got as far as a postdoc, jumping about here, that I got interested in sort of much more mechanistic chemistry or physical organic chemistry, as they call it, and really had to go back and relearn kinetics and that kind of thing in order to get that. So that's about as much physical chemistry I've liked. I've always been an organic chemistry kind of person. And so that's that, really. I suppose I carried on from there to do a doctorate because, well, I enjoyed doing it and I just wanted to do some more. And that seemed to be the way one did it. You know, I wasn't anything that. I had no career aspirations. Never really had any. I'll tell you a story about that later. So I carried on doing that and I did organic synthesis in my doctorate. I did, you know, asymmetric synthesis. Lots of it didn't work. Some of it did work. You know, that kind of thing. And I suppose it was at that point that, yeah, I saw a postdoc job and went for that. And it was in medicinal chemistry. And I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting. Well, I needed a job. Went for it. And actually, it was quite interesting because I realized very quickly that really medicinal chemistry, well, it's about synthesis. It's about basic molecular reactions and interactions, I should say, and polarity and, you know, hydrogen bonding and hydrophobic interactions, that kind of thing, which, yeah, kind of makes sense if you understand structural chemistry. And then there's some reactions, some metabolic reactions. And actually, once you have a basic idea of the sort of enzymes that are there in vivo and are going to metabolize your compound, again, suddenly it doesn't seem that different from synthetic chemistry, really. And once I realized I didn't actually have to learn the names of enormous proteins and what they did and sort of saw the world as, you know, in that kind of been described as blobology, you know, this idea where things aren't really molecules anymore, they're just sort of functional blobs interacting in some sort of network. It's not really me, that kind of thing. So once you realize you don't have to do that, you realize that actually medicinal chemistry is just chemistry, and as is most biology, really. And then, you know, it's fine, really. And the other thing I realized was that it's quite useful and quite a lot of people are quite interested in doing it and will pay for it too. So there you go. That's why I got into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were talking a bit about how you progressed from synthetic chemistry and the mechanistic stuff towards the blobology, right? Can you talk a bit more about what you're currently working on?
Yeah, so almost all of my research is commercially oriented medicinal chemistry. So my research group is a joint sort of academic industrial group because I have visiting fellows. They're actually employees of a company and they work in my lab and I collaborate with them. I collaborate with their boss there as well. And we design molecules, we make molecules, we develop new synthetic routes to known molecules and all that kind of thing. So yeah, it's mainly medicinal chemistry. It's a lot of different projects. That's what we do. I mean, I have no big vision in terms of going, yes, I'm the guy who works on this disease or that disease. No, it's not like that at all. It's very much working on things that we have to do now. Company has clients, you know, that they require stuff to be done. I can consult on those routes and help. And I have some students who work on some related chemistry because we're trying to solve some, I think, more underlying problems. Sort of known problems in medicinal chemistry as well, synthetic problems. So we work on a few of those as well. But yeah, it's quite a broad spectrum of med chem projects.
The interesting thing I always think with med chem is the fact that it is the combination of so many different disciplines, right? So you've got the synthetic stuff, you've got the computational stuff, you've got the biology stuff, and they've all got to come together and work well to come with a good result.
I think you're absolutely right. You sort of learn very quickly that you can't do all of it. And you've really got to collaborate. So, you know, I could spend another entire episode of this podcast talking about the importance of teamwork, right? You know, and why you need to work not only with people with the right skill set, people you get on with, people with whom you share a common goal and have the same, to be honest, the same reward drivers as well, right? You're all going for the same thing, for the same reason, with the same degree of drive, and that you have complementary sets of abilities. And yeah, absolutely. So work with biologists and computational chemists, because some of the work we do is working on process development and going, then obviously we have to work with regulatory consultants and experts in more legal aspects of chemistry as well. So yeah, lots of things, and you have all these meetings with various sets of people depending on the stage, how advanced the project is. Sometimes it's quite theoretical, sometimes it's quite applied, sometimes you're dealing with micrograms, sometimes you're dealing with kilograms. You know, it just depends on where the project is. And yeah, all of these things matter. And I think knowing that you want to work in a team is important. These kind of situations where stuff actually gets done rather than trying to be a sort of unitary force, which can be very, very difficult to achieve anything real.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think we've all worked in teams that we've struggled with, right? And I think finding a good group of people to collaborate with really does make a difference. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think having the people where everyone's pushing each other on is really great. And I think it leads to projects where there's low attrition rates for interest. I mean, never mind the actual like chemistry, biology. If you have a team that's demotivated, they'll never get anywhere, right? So did you ever find any challenges with motivation? What would you say is been your biggest hurdle that you've had to overcome?
That's hard. And the reason is very simple, is that I suppose in some level I'm quite a conservative person when it comes to myself and what I want to do. I'm not a massive risk taker, right? Actually, other people involved in the teams that I work are. I'm very much a kind of, I realized over the years that I realized see myself as being a problem solver, not a problem provider. I'm not saying I'm particularly good at solving problems. I'm just saying that, you know, I tend to work in a quite reactionary, you know, way in that way. I wonder if this is the opportunity for me to talk about how bad an academic I think I am, right? I think that's quite funny, right? So yeah, I think if I have any challenges, actually, it's working where my academic colleagues, I think, are here for a different reason than I am. I think I'm probably the odd one out or one in the minority. And that can be quite challenging, okay? And that's fine because the university has a model, academia has a traditional model, and it seems to involve writing grants and publishing papers and going on tours and giving lectures and all that kind of thing. And so if you think about those three things, I don't really do any of those. So I've got, you know, teaching load and an admin load and the research I do is this collaborative industrial research. And, you know, we don't really publish that, you know. And also I don't spend a lot of time having to look for funding because, you know, if the funding wasn't there, we wouldn't even start.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah,
that's how that works. And it's always stuff to do. So, you know, that's how that works. And so it's really interesting that I don't have to be a self-publicist, right? I don't have to go and advertise my stuff. I don't spend any time wondering if anybody has read anything I've ever done or if anybody cites my work or any of that. So yeah, that's quite liberating, but it's at the same time quite odd having that attitude working in a department where, you know, and that's fine because this is kind of what modern academia requires you to have that kind of, you know, grants, papers, you know, all that kind of thing. No, that's the sort of traditional model. But yeah, but watching other people do that and sometimes struggle, which is actually really tricky, mm-hmm. and watching people, I mean, it's sort of me walking around going, there is another way, you know, but it's quite,
yeah.
But I've been very fortunate, you know, and so to be in the situation that I am now, I don't know if it'll always work out for everybody, but yeah, it's a very odd thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Having to go through these processes and it's quite challenging. But I think it's really interesting how there really is two sides to the chemical research coin, right? With the academic and the commercial side. There's a lot of projects that go in academia that people don't, when they come up with the problems, they don't necessarily know the utility of the solutions. And that's true. You can find a lot of problems where once you've got a solution, you can try and fit it over another problem, right? Whereas the commercial stuff, obviously, it's very direct to the relevant problems. And I think that's quite interesting. But what would you say keeps you motivated to work on these problems? Obviously, you have to stay quiet about a lot of these problems and a lot of the difficult stuff, but equally a lot of the interesting stuff. So where would you say you find creativity and motivation for your ideas?
This is a really interesting thing. I could give you a very flippant answer, which is my inbox. Right? Literally, I don't have to worry about coming up with new things to do.
Yeah.
I have to, you know, answer problems, right? That's what I do. The problems are provided for me, right? And then I have to come up with interesting and hopefully creative and novel ways in order to solve them. But actually, once you've got the problem on the page, then usually, you know, it's quite easy just to get your head around that. I find not knowing the answer to something quite annoying. So that's it. So it's not that I've never felt that I had to be the person who'd come up with the question. There's a line in The West Wing. If any of you guys have listened to or watched The West Wing, greatest TV of all time, probably, in which at one point the president, Bartlett, he turns to one of his aides, Josh Lyman, and says, the difference between you and me is that, you know, I always wanted to be the guy and you just wanted to be the guy relies on. Hmm. And I think the thing is that I think I'm more that sort of person, actually. I quite like helping. I quite like solving other people's problems. I think it gives a direct focus to my time. I don't have to worry about keeping motivated. I don't have to worry about new ideas and new problems because there's always a stimulus. And once you've got that and you've got resource, which we have here, fantastic. You know, you've got the literature, you've got the labs, you've got, you know, everything we need, all the equipment we need. So there, you just do it. I mean, you know, it's not difficult mm-hmm. when you know that there, that's it. It's nothing particularly big or metaphysical or philosophical. Someone's just going, please, will you? Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. Okay. Yeah. You know, P.S. we're paying you. Oh, yeah, but that'd be the one. Yeah, the money, maybe the big motivation. What keeps the motivation? Answer, wishing to get paid. So, yeah, that's it, really. I don't have to look much further than that. At no point have I sat here in my office with my feet on the desk looking out the window, go, what am I going to do?
Yeah, it's never happened. Yeah. I think it's good. And I think it joins in with the discussion about the people that you put around you, right? And whether it be like the same level above or below you within your an organization. I think there is a real human driver to please other people. And I think if you've got teams where you can find victories and share those victories, you know, it really does help with motivation. Obviously, a paycheck really does show the good things, but I think finding the affirmation from colleagues really is
a powerful tool. You're completely right there. So the industrial people I work with, the guys who set up the company that I work with, I've worked with them since 1998. And previously, we've got as far as phase two clinical trials, right? So my desire is to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's it. Do it again and again and again. Because I really enjoyed that process. It was fantastic. And working with the guys was great. And what we did, it didn't work, by the way. The drug didn't actually, didn't work in the end. But getting there was really interesting. Learned lots. And yeah, it's that.
Yeah. It's challenging with the high attrition rates in med chem.
Oh, yeah. Well, indeed. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. To even get to phase two in the first place is a full career goal for a lot of chemists. It's just to contextualize it for some of the non-med chem listeners, it's absolutely crazy to have one of these.
You're right. So when I got here to the department, I got here in 2006, and I remember about 2007, 2008, whatever, I was having a chat with the head of the department at the time. We were having a conversation about career progression. And Mike was really good. He was trying to, you know, encourage me and all this kind of thing. You know, he's doing his job well. And I remember sort of sitting there having a conversation with him and thinking to myself, you know, have I peaked, right? Because, you know, it was 2008. I'd been here a couple of years. In order to get to Warwick, I'd been really, really fortunate. I'd applied for and gained a EPSRC fellowship to come here, a five-year fellowship. And at that point as well, I had a compound entering clinical trials. It was that one. It was going into phase one at that point. I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever, if you turned to me and said, you know, one day you will have won a five-year fellowship from EPSRC and you will have gained an academic position in a university and you've got a compound as far as clinical trials, you know, my God, that'd be amazing, right? So, yeah, so 2008, I sat here in my office as I am now and thought, yeah, I've done all that now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. I was done. You know, all the things I'd ever thought would be great to do, I'd done through good fortune, being in the right place, right time, knowing the right people. People who are successful, I think, don't often credit good fortune enough. Right? I will. Yeah. So since then, I would say I'm not struggling for motivation because I wanted to do that, you know, to do that again, not the EPSRC and the fellowship bit, but the drug discovery part of that. And so, yeah, that's what sort of kept me going, working with the same people and trying to do it again. So, yeah, it's interesting. Find the thing in life that, you know, keeps you going and do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting. You're absolutely right. A lot of people don't credit a lot to luck. But the way I've always viewed it is that in doing things that progress your understanding and develop your skills, you can reduce your need for luck. So luck is always a factor. I think in every academic journey, it takes a lot to get to professorships and heads of department and EPSRC grants, right? And I think it always takes a lot of skill, but it also takes quite a bit of luck sprinkled in with that.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, yeah, get some skills, understand the subject, really get into it. And so that when you do get lucky, you can take advantage of it, right? I think that's the point. You know, everybody needs a bit of luck to get started sometimes on something. But you kind of also need to be able to take advantage of that as well. So that, you know, you can't just wait around for stuff to happen. You have to kind of, you know, put your bid in, but, you know, then it's just dice rolling, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's interesting. I think when you develop these skills, you kind of start to move towards understanding and start moving towards the bleeding edge of your field and start to become an innovator. And I think it's pretty fair to say that with a phase two clinical trial, you're definitely an innovation field, right? But what does innovation mean to you? How do you define it?
I think there's a big difference between theoretically being able to solve the problem and actually solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of those is research and the other one is innovation, right? You know, it's, I've built a spanner. Does the spanner actually turn the nut? Theoretically, the spanner will turn the nut. Well, you haven't actually really done anything until you've turned the nut, have you? You know, and shown that it's actually quite a good spanner. And it may even be better than the other guy's spanner. You know, that's it. You know, this is the point. You know, you can design all the spanners in the world, but, you know, it's going to turn some nuts. I'll stop now with that. But but that's it. You know, that's the thing. I mean, academia is mainly about theoretically solving problems. You alluded to people kind of finding things. Academic research, I often, you know, this idea of randomly firing an arrow into a field, seeing where it lands, quickly painting a target around the arrow, going, look, I hit it. You know, because it's about, you know, solutions in need of a problem. And I think when you start doing projects like that, it's often quite difficult to genuinely innovate, because what you end up with is a sort of a slightly random and obscure way of solving something. And you've got to be really lucky to have hit something that actually of utility.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so I've sort of given up with that. So now it's, you know, it's all about pull, not push. It's all about the problem being presented in, you know, starkly in front of you. You know, here is this disease, and therefore here is this protein or this receptor you've got to interact a molecule with in some way or something like that. And so, yeah, that's it. It suddenly becomes very much that kind of that driver rather than this kind of, yeah, hey, let's have a go at this. I could do something like that. You know?
Yeah. That's really interesting. It always feels like these bi-directional systems with developing or just innovating, right? You have top-down and bottom-up leadership. You have problem-focused and solution-focused innovation. And it's interesting how all these things can go in two ways. And I think they present different benefits, and I think it's very suited to a person, right, and a team. Some people can be solutions focused, some people can be problem focused. And I think trying to find a balance between the two is often exactly what you need. Research will always be a case of trying things out, looking for those solutions and keeping focus on the problem. You may not always succeed. In fact, you'll probably more often fail than succeed. It's absolutely the way you have to be, and you've got to be quite hardy. You've got to be like an old oak tree, sturdy and having to stand up to the weathering. So what would you say your key learning or top piece of advice that you'd pass to anyone listening would be?
Yeah, well, we sort of touched on it, haven't we, in some fashion about finding something that you want to do and find a way to get paid to do it. I mean, it's that. It's for too many people, they go through education, they come out at the end and they're presented with some menu. And often it's based on some menu of expectation as well. This idea of going, well, if you've got a degree of this class from this institution in this subject, you're the sort of person who should go and do this, you know. And okay, well, you know, maybe you just like the teacher or you're just quite interested in the subject. And actually you don't want to do something like that at all. And that's fine, right? Ask yourself some basic questions. You know, indoors, outdoors, it's like people or not. Are you a sort of tinkerer, inventor, kind of engineer type person, or are you a sort of an analytical person, or are you a sort of process driven person? You know, and what kind of things do you want from your job? You know, just the money or a strong desire to just do it despite the money? I think there are so many things, and people see, you know, young people see people around them who have been successful, right? And they often, how do I get like that? How do I do this? And you realize actually that most of the time people, you know, your age then, weren't thinking about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said before, I'd vowed off all that biology malarkey. I'm not doing that. I deliberately didn't do biology You know, I did biology GCSE. I was the first year of GCSE, by the way, 1988, if you don't want to talk about that. Anyway, no. Moving on. it was, you just sort of have to find that pathway, as you would say, that's going to suit you. And don't worry too much about other people's expectations. And also what other people are doing. In fact, stop comparing yourself to other people. Because you're happier doing what you do.
Yeah, it's challenging. I've noticed I do it occasionally, and I think it's interesting how a lot of others will compare others' work, right? So I think I mentioned this recently on maybe like episode zero, that the fact that I had a Viva coming up. I had that Viva, and it went pretty well. But it was interesting to have my work compared to other people, you know. Because you kind of introspectively compare your work to others and you're like, oh, these big companies are doing similar things and I have to perform against them and compete. And I think it's good to have a competitive spirit, right? But I think if you let competition get in the way of actual innovation, you will just stop dead in the water, right?
I think you've got to know why you're doing what you're doing and you've got to be happy with that. And it's got to be because you want to do it. And that's it. And it ranges. I mean, I suppose you're talking about quite a sort of a technical, academic sort of job kind of thing here. I haven't talked as much about kind of personal stuff.
I think it's important, whether it be like comparison of yourself to teams in other countries or coworkers in an office or students in a lecture theatre, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Your colleagues, oh, he's cleverer than I am, or he's, you know, he knows some people, or he's got a placement that I haven't, or he's going to get a degree or whatever, and you end up in that kind of thing. And believe me, academia is just rife with that kind of thing.
It can be quite destructive, in my opinion. I've seen people sit in lecture halls and go, I can't do this, and lose the spark that they came into the department with. I think it's really important to keep that inspiration going. I think students come into these departments and start to progress their at least career in chemistry and any field, right? They've got this candle of inspiration and drive, and you've got to shield it. You've got to make sure you keep that flame alive and cover it from people trying to blow your candle out by comparing you to others. Make sure you shield it from the rain of the attrition from courses and the difficulty, and keep progressing and move out the wind, move into things that you actually enjoy, right? And I think that's absolutely right. Keeping a focus on yourself and making sure you enjoy what you do.
Talking of that, by the way, and for anybody else out there who's, can remember or, some of their first lectures or some of their undergrad lectures, which they were just sitting there going, what on earth is this? Yeah, my first lecture ever. The guy stood up at the front and he derived Einstein's specific heat capacity of a solid. It took him 50 minutes from first principles. It was an entire, enormous multiple blackboards full of chalk, and got to the end. And then we all walked out and I walked out going, I'm in the wrong place. What was that? What? Where are the curly arrows?
Yeah.
Fortunately, curly arrows, I think, were in the next hour, so it was okay. But I just absolutely stunned by that.
Yeah.
I still couldn't tell you anything about it, and I couldn't tell you, I understand it's possible, and I'm sure if I pulled out a book, I'd be able to, follow along. Couldn't do it myself now, never needed to. I don't know what that was for, that lecture, by the way. I think it was the benefit of the academic at the front, because I don't think anybody learnt anything else in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you're absolutely right. Don't, your candle, let's use your analogy, your candle needs air, it does not need wind.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it needs enough, but it doesn't need too much, because you don't want to get blown about by life's tribulations too much.
Exactly. I think that's some really good takeaways. How can any of our listeners connect with you or your work, with what you're up to?
Well, it's simple. My office door's there. Knock on my door. Knock on my door. Seriously. Email me. That's it. Right. I mean, that's mainly my view of the world. I have a Twitter account, but I don't tweet. In fact, I can admit right now that I've basically abandoned my Twitter account and I've actually started one of those anonymous locked ones just so I can use it as a news feed, because actually I don't really have anything to say. The things I do want to say, I probably can't say. And so that, you know, for legal reasons, for IP confidentiality reasons. And so therefore, I just don't really say very much.
Yeah.
But no, I use Twitter as a news feed. So you're not going to really learn anything from me on there. I'm here at Warwick,
Your office is on the fifth floor, right?
Yes. I'm on the fifth floor.
Okay, perfect. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Fox, listening to your story and talking about your work and how to keep motivated during the long hours of development up to these kind of points in your career. I think that's absolutely great. And just kind of big takeaway is just look after your candle, I feel, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, let it lead you where you want to go, right? You know, there we go. That's getting a bit metaphorical there, isn't it? But yeah, absolutely. No, thanks, Matt. It's been great. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fantastic. This has been the Pathways podcast from Warwick Chemistry, produced by Beau Celestin and myself, Matt Taylor. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.